Welcome to this 11KBW podcast on Horizon Scanning, Life After Brexit, AI, Automated Decision Making by Timothy Pitpain QC. This talk was given at the 11KBW Information Law Conference at the Kelvin Theatre, IET London Savoy Place. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.
Horizon Scanning. And the first of my five topics is data protection after Brexit. And I remember last year talking about data protection after Brexit and what would happen if we got a no-deal scenario. So there is a slight flavour of Groundhog Day, for me at any rate. And if this bit of the presentation is Groundhog Day, well, what character am I going to be? And I think I might have to be Punxsutawney Phil, the prognosticating groundhog. Looking ahead, are we heading for the sunlit uplands, or is it going to be five more weeks of winter? So, what's happened? We did, of course, leave the EU at 11 p.m. on the 31st of January 2020 without the Big Ben bongs. I suppose if I was the Prime Minister, I might at this point do a call and response with you and try and get you to do the 11 Big Ben bongs, but I'm not going to go there. And in a way, in the short term, it's all a bit of an anticlimax, because for the time being, of course, there's very little practical change, either in relation to data protection law or in relation to EU law generally, because under with the withdrawal agreement, as given effect by the 2020 Act in this country, EU law continues to apply as before, effectively, during an implementation period which runs to the end of this year, 31st of December. So the really exciting question is what happens at the end of the implementation period. Well, what is due to happen at that point is that, of course, the GDPR will carry on operating as part of UK law. It'll be retained in UK law under Section 3 of the European Union Withdrawal Act 2018. And at that point, when we leave the implementation period, what is due to happen is that there will be various technical changes to the retained GDPR and to the 2018 Act, which are set out in that 2019 SI, and those are effectively there to make sure that the GDPR can carry on working as part of UK law. What about data transfers from the UK to the EU and vice versa? What are they going to look like after the end of this year? Well, UK to EU transfers, in principle, shouldn't be problematic so long as the UK recognises the adequacy of EU countries from the point of view of the UK GDPR. And we can look back at the DCMS guidance that was issued prior to exit and looking forward to the risk of a no deal. And at that point, the DCMS was saying, well, we will transitionally recognise all of the EU states and the EU institutions as providing an adequate level of protection for UK purposes. As far as transfers the other way are concerned, UK, EU to UK, that's a more difficult question because the issue there is going to depend on whether there is a finding of adequacy at that point. And if not, issuing a lawful basis, identifying a lawful basis for those transfers will be challenging. There was an EDPB paper back in February last year about possible bases for UK, for EU to UK transfers following a no-deal Brexit. Short point there, it's quite difficult at any rate to find a magic bullet solution that covers everything. we will be in a similar position, I think, if we don't get an adequacy finding. So the big question is, are we going to get such a finding at the end of the transition period? And there are various straws in the wind on this. I think the bottom line is there are clearly massive advantages in having an adequacy finding, both from a UK and, I would suggest, from an EU point of view. But on the other hand, it's clearly not a done deal yet. So looking at some of the documentation that's been produced since we left, firstly, on the 3rd of Feb, there was a commission recommendation for a council decision on negotiations for the future UK-EU partnership. And that referred to an adequacy decision as being an enabling factor for cooperation between the UK and the EU, particularly in law enforcement. So that was positive. But then there's some rather more negative stuff from the European Parliament in the resolution that they passed a few days later on the 12th of February on the negotiations for the future Parliament, for the future partnership. It's a long resolution, but if one looks at paragraph 32 in that resolution, it picks out three areas of concern about UK data processing. One is the wide exemption for the processing of personal data for immigration purposes. The second is the UK's approach to electronic communications data. And the third is the UK's general approach to questions of national security and law enforcement. Now, Parliament wasn't saying, do not give these people an adequacy finding, but Parliament was saying, in order to give an adequacy finding, you're going to need to look very closely at these specific areas. And then the EDPS opinion on Feb 24th picked up on those concerns, and they say, essentially, the Union, the EU, should prepare for all eventualities, including the eventuality that there is no adequacy decision. And that opinion specifically drew attention to Parliament's concerns. What about the UK? What is the UK saying? Well, there was a UK government statement on future cooperation on the 27th of February, so that came too late to make it into these slides. And that gives a rather mixed picture, I think, because first of all, you have the statement that the UK will have an independent policy on data protection at the end of the transition period. So we are free to go our own way. But then immediately afterwards, the statement says that we will seek adequacy decisions, both under the GDPR and under the Law Enforcement Directive, before the end of the transition period. And it also says rather vaguely that we will seek appropriate arrangements to allow continued cooperation between the ICO and EU data protection authorities. So I think something of a mixed picture there. What one doesn't have in that UK government statement is anything that says, we note that the European Parliament has expressed these concerns, and don't worry, we're on the case, we're going to deal with it. So I think there may be quite a lot out of uncertainty and finger crossing and holding of breath before we actually find out whether we are going to get an adequacy decision at the end of this year. So much for Brexit. I wanted to say now, and this is my second subject, I wanted to talk a bit about facial recognition technology, the thing that Julian got to at the end of his paper but didn't actually deal with. You often find that there is a technology that is very much in the news and people are very much concerned about. And at the moment, facial recognition technology seems to be flavour of the month. Of course, in the UK, we had the Bridges case, which found that the use of that technology in a very limited pilot project by the South Wales Police was okay, both under Article 8 and under the Data Protection Act 2018 law enforcement provisions. I think the key takeaway from the Bridges case, when one looks towards the future, is the court held it was okay that there wasn't any specific legal framework in UK law that dealt specifically with this technology. In other words, it was good enough that this fell within the police's general common law powers in relation to the prevention and detection of crime, including the power to hold information for that purpose. And there was a whole policy framework about police information, and that was enough to satisfy the requirement under Article 8 for any interference with the privacy right under Article 8 to be in accordance with law. So, from the point of view of facial recognition technology, a cautious green light in the UK in Bridges. A rather more mixed picture elsewhere in the EU, and an interesting case from the Swedish Data Protection Authority in the context of school attendance. Why is Sweden so keen about school attendance? Perhaps it's the Greta effect and all those school strikes that they're trying to keep an eye on. But in any event, a particular school, it's another pilot project, a particular school uses facial recognition as part of automating the school registration process. So all those Rowan Atkinson skits where you have a schoolmaster going through school registration, you wouldn't be able to do that in Sweden, or at least not in this particular school. The school that went down this route, they were fined the equivalent of about $29,000, despite the fact that they'd sought parental consent, and despite the fact that they had carried out, at any rate, some kind of a data protection risk assessment. So the Swedish regulator took a much tougher line than the UK court did in Bridges. In particular, as far as the consent basis was concerned, the regulator said, well, parental consent wasn't good enough because of the imbalance of power between the school and parent. In relation to the processing of biometric data, they said, well, that's special category, that's Article 9, and a condition hasn't been satisfied. And as far as the paperwork was concerned, the data protection impact assessment, not good enough. So a much tougher line from the Swedish regulator than from the UK court in Bridges. It may be a straw in the wind as to whether EU states are going to take a tougher line on this than the UK. In the run-up to the recent EU Commission white paper on AI, there were quite a lot of news reports, both in the Financial Times and then in the BBC in January, that the EU was considering a prohibition on the public use of facial recognition technology for up to 5 years. But when the Commission white paper came out on the 19th of February, it didn't actually say anything about such a ban, and indeed the references to facial recognition technology in that white paper were very limited. So it looks as if, at any rate for the time being, at EU level, there's been a stepping back from seeking to do anything general about facial recognition technology. Now, then my third subject area, again, this is something that is, I think, rather flavour of the month at the moment. artificial intelligence and related subjects. So the use of terminology in this area, first of all, how much difference does this technology actually make? Because, of course, the idea that you collect a lot of information about people and then apply a set of rules to that information, that's something that's been going on for a very long time, either on the basis of manual processing of personal information or on the basis of automated processing. For example, credit scoring we've had for 30 years or more, and that was a subject of early enforcement action under the 1984 Data Protection Act. So in one sense, this is nothing new. In another sense, what's new is the scale and the speed on which algorithmic decision-making can be deployed. There was a lot of talk a few years ago about big data, the idea that you could collect massive data sets and then mine them automatically, looking for correlations which you might never have come across on the basis of purely manual processing. So, for example, the famous big data story about the Target store in the United States that was analyzing people's shopping baskets for the purpose, among other things, of working out which shoppers were pregnant. That was a big data story. Artificial intelligence, here what people are usually meaning is the use of computers to replicate what human beings do. For example, translation from one language to another, or driving a car. Machine learning, I think, goes one stage further. The idea that you've got a computer algorithm for a particular task, and it's self-correcting. So the algorithm can improve itself, update itself, and get better at its task as it goes along. And the implication of that is that you may be left with a situation where actually nobody understands quite how the computer is reaching the conclusions that it does, because it's gone beyond its own initial programming. A whole range of contexts where this kind of technology might be used, either in the public or the private sector. Credit scoring, I mentioned before, a familiar example. Assessing the risk of reoffending. There was some very interesting commentary from the Public Law Project blog following a lecture by Lord Sales last year. And the PLP gave the example of a program that was used by Durham Police when assessing the risk of reoffending in order to decide whether to go down essentially a prosecution law enforcement route or an alternative route of disposal. With offending, looking at 34 different factors, one of them being the person's postcode. So, quite literally, a postcode lottery in law enforcement. But, of course, very difficult to work out in any individual case, well, what role did that individual's postcode play in the disposal of that particular case? And then things like medical diagnosis, welfare benefits. The EU settled status scheme, that's been a very familiar example of automated decision making, with people getting an initial decision, yes or no to settled status, on the basis of an automated process. And then if they don't get the decision they want from that process, they can go on and provide further information. And a whole range of concerns that have been expressed about this kind of decision making. And again, the lecture I mentioned last year by Lord Sales on this subject is a really interesting discussion of those various concerns. So, first of all, does it make decision-making opaque? Are we in a situation where not just the citizen or the consumer, but the people who were responsible for running the system don't really understand how the decision has been made? And then a particular concern that Lord Sales flagged up, are you ruling out the application of human judgment or the application of discretion? Usually when you've got a system of rules being applied by a human being, well, very often there'll be some margin of discretion where you can say, well, under the rules, this is what the conclusion would be. But in fact, there's this extra factor here that wasn't really envisaged when the rules were drawn up. And so we're going to need to reach a different conclusion. How do you incorporate that element of discretion or equity in an automated decision-making process? And then thirdly, a really big one, does AI replicate existing sources of bias? I went to a lecture earlier this year by somebody who specialized in ethics around artificial intelligence. And he had some hair-raising examples, largely from the States, of bias in AI systems. As, for example, systems assessing people's creditworthiness that on the basis of identical financial information for men and women would give the man 10 times or 20 times the credit limit as the woman. Another notorious example that emerged a few years ago and was quite widely publicized, an automated system for recognizing whether there were faces in a series of video images or not, not who they were, but were they human faces or something else, and a significant rate of failing to recognize non-white faces as being human. And so not surprisingly, you then get the fourth concern, the effect of AI on the perceived legitimacy of decisions. If you don't know who has made a decision and you don't know how they've made the decision, are you going to accept it as legitimate? It's difficult enough sometimes in litigation to get losers' consent. I think one has an intuition as a lawyer and as an advocate, and it may just be based on what we're used to, that there is a real value in a process where a bunch of people sit in a room together and one person has to be seen to listen to what everybody else says and then deliver a decision either in writing or orally then and there. And you don't get that with an automated decision-making process. And then there's the question, again, from the lawyer's point of view, well, what are the legal tools that we've got to try and exercise some kind of control over AI-based decision-making? And there's a range of possible controls there. One, of course, is if you look at the GDPR, a right under Article 22 not to be subject to a decision that is based solely on automated processing, including profiling, if that decision produces legal effects or is similarly significant in its effects. But there's quite a lot of wiggle room in that definition. There's quite a lot of room for maneuver. First of all, if you have a human element that comes in right at the very end, so right at the end of the process, a human being looks at the outcome and says either, yeah, that looks right, or, ooh, we need to look at that again. Is that a sufficient human element? And also, what do we mean by producing legal effects or similarly significant effects? There's the possibility, though I don't think we've yet seen this in action, for FOIA to operate as a kind of constraint, at least in relation to government decision-making, if it can be used as a tool for getting further information about algorithms that are used in government decision-making. There's also the question of judicial review techniques. I think this is one of the points where, at any rate in the public sector, information law and public law potentially overlap. Particularly the developing idea in judicial review of a systemic challenge to, for example, a policy. We saw that recently in the Miller case about the hate crime operational guidance. Not an AI case at all, but a case of some interest to information lawyers. the idea that you can challenge a policy or a system simply because it creates an unacceptable level of risk of unlawful outcomes. And then finally, one of the suggestions that Lord Sales floated in his lecture was that one could have some kind of independent agency or commission that would actually regulate algorithms in advance and approve them or reject them. So in terms of recent contributions to that debate, I've mentioned that intervention by Lord Sales a couple of times. The ICO is currently consulting on a proposed AI auditing framework. I think that that is partly intended to help data controllers do their own DPIAs in relation to applications of AI, and it's also an indication of how the ICO itself will approach those when it's carrying out any audits. And then something I mentioned a little earlier on, the EU white paper from the 19th of February. And I mean, getting anything very clear and specific from that document is a little bit like nailing jelly to a wall. It's full of aspirational EU speak. What does it actually add up to? Well, it's very much on the one hand this, on the other hand that. It's a little bit like the preamble to the 1995 directive, in fact. On the one hand, AI is a really good economic opportunity for the EU, and we don't want to fall behind. And by the way, it'll help us tackle climate change as well. On the other hand, of course, we need to make sure that it is done in a way that respects people's fundamental rights. So the white paper talks about an ecology of excellence and an ecology of trust, and we need both of those things. And interestingly, one of the suggestions there is that applications of AI may need to go through some kind of prior approval process to ensure that they meet the fundamental rights requirement, including in the way that they deal with personal data and data privacy. It's not clear who would have the job of carrying out that kind of prior assessment, whether this is going to be an additional task for EU data protection regulators, or whether it will go to somebody else instead. Of course, to the extent that anything that comes out of that white paper is specifically related to data protection and personal data, it has a potential bearing on the UK, A, as to whether we will get an adequacy finding, B, perhaps more likely, whether we will retain our adequacy finding in the future. So I think it may be an example of perhaps a wider theme that even if we succeed in getting an adequacy finding in the course of this year, we will then need to keep an eye on the extent to which there's any divergence between the UK and the EU on data protection issues, because that divergence may put that adequacy finding at risk. And the whole field of AI is just an example of that.
Tim, if I could just ask you to take one more minute.
Yeah. So just very briefly, online harms, a lot of concern about online harms, particularly in relation to things like extremist content online, and a consultation response earlier last month from the government suggesting a proposed wider role for Ofcom in that area. Some of the responses suggested the ICO might have a role, but the government is looking at Ofcom instead. And finally, that notion of surveillance capitalism, which surfaced last year in a big fat book by Zuboff, who is an American management studies professor. She was arguing that things that organizations like Google and Facebook do are a fundamentally new form of capitalism, needing its own new forms of regulation. And as you can see from those two quotes, she's quite sceptical of the whole idea of surveillance capitalism. And perhaps one of the underlying themes in the courts and the regulators, one might see it, for instance, in the Lloyd...